change gonna
come. CIUT 89.5 Toronto.
And we're back. This is Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. That wasn't Brian, pardon me, that wasn't Lee Morgan. It was Brian and Thomas Owen, A Change Gonna Come. And I believe we're joined now by Canada's best known and most energetic and productive journalist, Eve Engler, and who's got a new book, Left, Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Good. Good to hear from you. Well, we better tell people right off the bat, you are going to be visiting Toronto sometime soon to speak about this book.
Yeah, on September 22nd at the World Beyond War Conference. Mm-hmm. And then two events on September 23rd, one at OISE at 2 p.m. and one at Friends House at 7 p.m. on NDP Palestine. And people can get the details on my website, evengler.com.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just tell our listeners, by the way, the Taylor Report's available, SoundCloud, Taylor-Report, and Facebook, The Taylor Report. Well, I really am enjoying this book. I have not yet finished it, but it ain't going to take long. It's Black Rose Books. It's very readable. I guess, you know, Eve, what I like about your book is that you talk about important policymakers and political leaders in Canada in a way that they don't ordinarily get discussed. We have a lot of our journalism tends to admire and offer op-ed page space to people that we're told, you know, kind of they're the ones who know. And you look into some of the think tanks, you look into the political parties, and you identify people who have been really either misleading or just inept and shouldn't be there. I'd like to start with, actually use a living example right now that I'm concerned about. The U.S., who is going through a kind of an emotional meltdown over how people might be meddling in their affairs, it might be the Russians, or pardon me, it is the Russian. Everything that happens is the Russian. And meddling is bad, and it just destroys democracy, et cetera. At the same time, we read that in the New York Times, and I saw it on CNN, that the U.S. Officials have met several times with Venezuelan army officers they describe as renegades, and which to them is a plus. That's a good, it's supposed to be good, over whether or not a coup should happen. And why? And meanwhile, when I look at Parliament, all I ever see on the subject of Venezuela are sort of a rooting section for let's get rid of Maduro. Am I wrong about that picture?
No, unfortunately, you're not wrong about that picture. I mean, while we have a foreign minister that has been really campaigning to weaken the elected government in Venezuela, you know, through the Lima group of right-wing foreign ministers of different countries in the hemisphere, through many, many visits with Caribbean countries, through many public comments, tweets, critical of the Venezuelan government, through funding opposition forces within Venezuela. You have Canada clearly aligned with sanctions, not to mention the sanctions that the UN have condemned. You have opposition, NDP, either cheerleading. Foreign critic Hélène Lavadière has sometimes taken quite over-the-top criticism of the Venezuelan government, and or silence. So you obviously have silence regarding the recent New York Times report of Trump administration plotting a coup with with some elements of the military in Venezuela. You have silence over Trump a year ago calling for an invasion of Venezuela. You have silence over Rex Tillerson, former head of diplomacy for the U.S. State Department, calling for a coup. So you have very little opposition to interventionist foreign policy from the supposed left wing opposition party.
Mm-hmm. And here we staying in our hemisphere, we have in Brazil the most popular and certainly the most progressive leader that we've seen in decades. I mean, actually, I don't know when Brazil has ever had a leader of the quality of Lula. And he's been criminalized. And again, all I hear is silence here. His party said, we want to run him. The people, it's clear from the polls, would vote for him. But instead, he's in jail or close to it. I think he's in maybe house arrest. I criticize myself for not even knowing, but it's because
he's in jail. Yeah,
the way that this subject is treated is very in a cavalier. That's a major country that really needs progressive leadership. And again, I don't see Parliament saying, "Well, let's form a committee, a bipartisan, and go down and do some fact finding. Let's behave in an independent way. Look, Canadians gather our own facts." Your book points out that they just don't operate that way.
I mean, the NDP and much of the groups kind of supportive of the NDP, the book deals with the foreign policy of left institutions, unions, think tanks, CCPA, Rideau Institute, and stuff like that. They take their cues from the NDP, and the NDP to a large extent just follows the media, right, on foreign policy issues. And they keep talking about the right wing candidate that was stabbed a couple days ago in Brazil as the most popular candidate. Well, in fact, that's the most popular candidate being allowed to run. Lula is twice as popular. About 40% of people said they would vote for Lula. But the NDP doesn't take this up. They take up criticism of the government in Venezuela. Again, because that's what the media is largely reporting, they don't take up the fact that you have the most popular candidate in Brazil being blocked from running, and that's the to a large extent their orientation is what the media is covering and the importance of activism. There are instances where you can break through that, but that's because of dogged activism by grassroots groups, and that takes a whole lot of effort. And there have been instances where, they push the NDP to adopt a NATO policy, but that literally took two decades of activism within the party and broader shifts to bring about. So,
well, by the way, if Canada, I'm glad you raised that, because it used to be a doctrinal position of the party that not to be remain in NATO, because why does NATO exist, actually? And what part, being the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, why is it in Afghanistan and Iraq, which don't, really not North Atlantic countries? But they are basically NATO socialists, aren't they? Or if we're going to call them, we use the word social. How about NATO social democrats? They like NATO.
Tom Mulcair was very clear during the 2015 election that Canada, the NDP foreign policy, is a NATO-oriented foreign policy, and they've supported obviously the NATO bombing of Libya in 2011 quite aggressively. The NDP supported that deployment of troops on NATO missions in Eastern Europe. They've also in recent times actually criticized the Trudeau government from the right, if you like, from a militarist perspective, when they announced a big huge increase in Canadian military spending, NDP defense critic Randall Garrison said that the money was not being put up immediately. This is last year's 60%, I believe it was, increase in military spending plan. And Randall Garrison criticized it for not coming right away. We want more of that money to be seen in the next budget or upcoming budget. So they have definitely taken a pro-militarist policy. With regard to NATO specifically, the NDP immediately supported NATO's creation in 1949, which Canada was one of three Britain, Canada, and the U.S. were the main players creating NATO. And then they backed NATO for decades. Finally, the NDP convention in 1969 was able to push forward a Canada out of NATO policy. And then the leadership in the late 1980s, without ever formally getting rid of that position, basically pushed that position aside. So there is that. That's a kind of question where there is this debate within the party. But the party has taken a pro-militarist position. I mean, the big $60 billion naval procurement plan that Canada's in the midst of, that's going to, their expectation is going to cost $100 billion over the lifetime. The NDP has staunchly supported that going back 7, 8, 9 years, and tried to isolate a friend, an activist friend out in Halifax, tried to isolate her because of her position on against that, and the question of what that expansion of the Canadian Navy, what that's about. We don't talk about that. We don't talk about the Canadian naval ships that have engaged in gunboat diplomacy in the Caribbean. We don't talk about the Canadian naval ships that are, you know, patrolling in the Middle East right now, have patrolled off the coast of West Africa, and according to their own internal discussions about that, about you know, concern about Nigerian oil. So the NDP has very much aligned behind militarist forces within this country.
Yeah. You know, you point out, and by the way, the title of the book is Left, Right. It's a nice looking book, by the way, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. It's Eve Engler, and you can get information at, is it eveengler.com?
Eveengler.com, yes.
Yeah. Eve is going to be talking, be here in Toronto. That's September 22nd, by the way?
September 22nd at 6 p.m. at Ontario College of Art and Design. There's a big World Beyond War conference, and then on Sunday at two different events at OASE.
You raise one of the stories from the past that has some traction is that, well, at one time there was the waffle, and it had, took a stab at trying to take NDP in a more leftward direction, ended up badly. But there was a thinker involved who has a reputation of being, I didn't think the idea was that he was anti-imperialist. I mean, George Grant, A Lament for a Nation. You go into him, his thinking, and also his influence. And I think you quote James Laxer saying that it was like a demigod or something. His book was the Bible or whatever, if I characterize it right. What was going on there with this phenomenon with George Grant?
Well, that's I go at it through the lens of left nationalism, right? And the waffle promoting this left nationalism, which has been incredibly influential in on the left in Canada. And if you look at George Grant's book, he celebrates John A. Macdonald, he celebrates Robert Borden, prime ministers. He openly celebrates British imperialism, what he doesn't do is why he's portrayed positively by left nationalists is because he has this sort of anti-American current. He's a descendant of was a descendant of the United Empire loyalists, those who fought with the British Empire during the American independence, the idea that he's considered George Grant's considered in his book. Was, I think James Lachs's quote is something like he woke up a whole generation of young people, and I mean it's certainly not anti-imperialism. It's in some cases very openly supportive of imperialism, and there's a whole current of left nationalist thought. James Laxer, for instance, I quote where he, in his 2008 book about Afghanistan, he basically bemoans that Canadian business class are not more expansionist in their international operations. Well, anyone who takes a look at the mining industry, for instance, would find out that the Canadian business class is incredibly expansionist. Take a look at the Canadian banking industry, which has been dominant force throughout the hemisphere for a century, certainly in the Caribbean, more than a century, and the dominant banking force with all that has meant for Caribbeans in terms of loss of sovereignty, in terms of profits coming back to Toronto or Montreal or wherever. Mm-hmm. And so this is the, you know, the left nationalist, even the progressive end of left, the most progressive end of left nationalism, which I think the waffle James Laxer maybe sort of represented, has this incredible blind spot about Canadian foreign policy. Basically, buy into and promulgate the myth of benevolent Canada in world affairs, and that's something that it's not, I don't think, quite as strong ideologically today as it was, you know, a couple decades ago. But there's still quite a bit of lingering of that ideology that I think that we need to directly discuss and I think move beyond as progressives or as the left.
Yeah, there is a language that they're very comfortable with, which is at the end of the day seems to me a missionary language. We have to do good in the world. Well, once you say that, you need a ship and you need troops and you need a plane and you need some helicopter. Because how are you going to do any good unless you land and start doing good, right?
And force them to take the good.
Yeah, well, it's like your dad says, you got to take it, it's good for you. And you don't want to get a smack. I'm seeing the return of the thinking of responsibility to protect. I'm reading, you know, seeing more and more things where it's time for Canada to really step up and start protecting people again. Is that, and once again, I think that the people from Stephen Lewis and Bob Ray would be people who associated with that. Certainly Alan Rock and Mr. Axworthy, I see them once again beating the drums. One of your points is they don't ever discuss this as though they're dealing with an empire, both British, American, and a history of being an empire. They only see it, let's be an empire for good. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, this goes further to the left than the necessarily the individual you cited. I mean, Stephen Lewis is identified more as a left, and I have a section where I go into Stephen Lewis's foreign policy. And his only criticism of Canada is, particularly with regards to Africa, his only criticism is that Canada doesn't do more. We're not giving more aid. There's no criticism about the Canadian mining companies that are extracting billions of dollars of profit every year. There's no criticism of even how aid has been used to oust governments, Kwame Nkrumah in Africa, Canadian aid used for that. No criticism of Canada's role in pushing structural adjustment programs with aid. No criticism of a whole history of Canadian imperialism or undermining of African sovereignty. That type of thinking underpins the whole responsibility to protect doctrine, and it goes pretty deep into left circles like the Rideau Institute, which is the only left-wing think tank in Canada, which does good stuff on a whole bunch of issues with regards to militarism. They promote responsibility to type thinking. They got people who were part of the UN mission in Haiti in 2004 that overthrew elected government that was responsible for thousands of people being killed, all under the the rubric of responsibility to protect. The ideology of more Canada, it seeps pretty far into left world. Even though when you take a look at the historical record of what Canada has done in the world, if you look at what's driving Canadian foreign policy, you find that overwhelmingly it's support for empire, historically British, today American, and support for Canadian corporate interests.
Mm-hmm.
We need to directly challenge that ideology of more Canada, responsibility to protect, and as if the world's going to be better if we just intervene in more places.
Yeah, you know, we were just speaking to Danny Haifong, an American journalist, writes a Black Agenda report, and he was pointing out that, you know, the poison of American exceptionalism, Canada sort of is a sort of a sub-partner in that exceptionalism, right? Because the same assumption here is we're only here to do good, so you can't, whatever we do, it is well-intentioned. it seems to be part of this. And I got to mention that you and some other authors, but I remember you very distinctly on this subject of removal of Aristide, and then the role played by Canada in the removal of Aristide, and to coming through to now 2018, we are protecting Haitians from their right to choose Aristide to be their leader. Isn't that what we're doing?
We've been doing that for 14, 15 years, and we've been aligned against the majority poor in the country. And you talk about intervention and all the stuff of, you know, right now we're hearing reports about the communication security establishment concern that Russia's going to intervene in the 2019 election here and stuff like that. Well, in 2003, we held a meeting in Ottawa to discuss Haiti's future, where we had officials from the French government, from the Bush administration, and the Organization of American States. No one from Haiti's elected government was invited, and they decided that Aristide, the elected president, must go. Haiti should be put under UN trusteeship. Haitian military should be recreated. 13 months later, Aristide's gone. The UN occupied Haiti for sort of still, but directly for 14 years or 13 years. And Haitian military was sort of partially recreated. There's no clearer example of intervening in other countries' political affairs than that. But that, of course, doesn't count because it wasn't the Russians.
Yeah, that's and where we started. I mean, this is they end up pleased with themselves that they are helping prevent the exercise of democracy by people in allegedly sovereign countries. I mean, well, they violated the sovereignty by removing the leaders or helping in the case of Lula.
In the case of Haiti, there were people on the left who celebrated the UN mission that Canada was part of in Haiti. They tended to back off because there was this Canada-Haiti Action Network movement that started exposing. But there are examples of fairly prominent people on the left supporting that just total betrayal of democracy, because they have a whole conception of Canada in the world of UN peacekeeping. UN peacekeeping, by definition, is a good thing, according to the NDP, according to the Rideau Institute, according to much of the left foreign policy discussion, even though we have the example of Haiti ousting elected government through UN. We have the example of the Congo in the early 1960s. Canada, through the UN, played a role in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. And even if you want to go back historically, it's slightly more complicated, but even the war in Korea was a UN mission where 3 to 4 million people were killed. So just because it's done under the rubric of the UN doesn't necessarily make it a benevolent endeavor. And you had other examples, be it UN in Rwanda, other examples too.
By the way, you have a great chapter there on dealing with Romeo Dallaire, and I compliment you on that. Actually, every chapter in this book is interesting and very, very helpful. I like the concept and the conclusion. You say you want to move the left to the left. it's a good idea. Probably, I was saying to Danny Haifong, we're probably going to find another word for them, because at the end of the day, they're not left. This is, you know, this is people who got are given that name, but you just described conduct, which should say, nope, you're out.
Well, I mean, my reading of it is that basically if you want to rise to positions of influence, be it from a left-wing think tank to be a commentator on CBC, basically you have to concede to the dominant mythology on foreign policy in general, but on foreign policy disturbingly, or it's most clear how the concession. And but when you actually get into it with most NDP members, when you get into it with most activists within labor unions, you'll find, or just activists in general, you'll find that there's much more sympathy for real internationalism, much more of a desire to not to be an imperialist force, not to be scared. Individuals are not scared of calling Canada an imperial force in the world. But if you get close to any position of influence within even the left world, then you become very scared of of using a term like that.
Yes, self censorship. Eve Engler, it's great talking to you. We look forward to seeing you here in September. The book is Left Right, and it's eveengler.com. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
Okay, bye bye. Eve Engler.